This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Today is April 23rd, 2010. This is another session in the ongoing oral history of Reed Hall. Reed, one last question from our session dealing with the Alumni Association, and that is, how do you see the Wisconsin Alumni Association in the governance of the university in the decades ahead, in the role that it could play and or that you think it should play?
Good question, Bob. I look on the Alumni Association as one leg of the table that supports the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Mm-hmm. Other legs are the foundation, of course, the athletic department, mm-hmm. And then the main leg is the administration of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, the chancellor's office, and on down. But I think the role of the Wisconsin Alumni Association complements what the rest of the university does. It's a separate corporation. The staff of the Alumni Association are not employees of the University of Wisconsin or the state of Wisconsin. In that sense, they're like the foundation, which is a separate corporation. Going forward, I think the Alumni Association and alumni relations will continue to be a very critical part of the future of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, especially as state funding becomes less substantial than it is now. Mm-hmm. There's going to be more of a need for private support. And in that sense, we complement what the foundation does as far as building relationships over time that translates ultimately into gifts to the University of Wisconsin-Madison through the foundation. We do not do a great deal of fundraising ourselves directly, although we are involved in this 150-year anniversary project of the Alumni Association right now. But for the most part, all the fundraising for this university is concentrated in the foundation. And I think that's the way it needs to be from an efficiency standpoint.
Now, Reed, in the course of doing these interviews, my general sense from faculty, both emeritus and current, is that it is inevitable that the UW-Madison is going to become a private university, essentially, that the public support or public money is going to continue to decline and decline precipitately. And if, in fact, that's the case, that moves up the role of the Alumni Association considerably, doesn't it? I mean, if we're going to become private, you really need a very engaged alumni base.
I personally don't think the university will ever become totally private, like one thinks of as the large private institutions in the country. Uh-huh. I don't think the land-grant colleges, with their initial charter, can become private, my own judgment. I think support from the state of Wisconsin will continue to be important, although it's not going to be growing substantially as we go forward. But I think the concept that this is a new Harvard probably is not in my thinking process for the future. Mm-hmm. If you believe in all the things that created the university so many years ago, mm-hmm. in the land-grant college charter, I think this institution will remain a public institution. If it's private, the tuition becomes even more dear than mm-hmm. it is now. I think public support is critical. Private charitable support is also critical for the future. But I just don't see the University of Wisconsin-Madison becoming a private school in the sense of the Eastern private schools that we think of.
I would agree with you. I think there's been more suggestion that we will become like the University of Michigan, where public financial support is 10% or less.
That's possible. I would not think that's going to happen in the near future. I think one of the things the university needs to do is to continue developing a good relationship with our Wisconsin State Legislature. And I'm certainly aware of all the restraints on the budget, not only for education, but also for science development, whatever, Medicaid funding, a lot of budgetary issues in the at the other end of State Street. But I think, given this state's heritage, I think we'll continue to have public support from the other end of State Street.
I hope you're right.
All right.
Reed, I want to ask you now to switch your attention to what was a very major episode in your life and the life of the Marshfield Clinic. And it's important in this history, both because the Marshfield Clinic is significant in the state. You are an alum and a past president of the Alumni Association. One of the other chief players in this situation is Tom Hefty, also a graduate of UW-Madison. And the university certainly has a lot of interest in healthcare and has received considerable largesse from the Blue Cross and Blue Shield at a later point. So I want to ask you about the legal issues between the Marshfield Clinic and Blue Cross and Blue Shield, starting with maybe some background on the Greater Marshfield Community Health Plan and what led to the lawsuit.
I think to understand the lawsuit and what unfolded after the lawsuit was filed, and currently, you have to go back to 1972, when a joint venture was formed for a trial of an HMO in the state of Wisconsin. And Mel Laird was instrumental in helping us get the initial blessing for this HMO. That was the beginning of the HMO legislative effort in the early 70s.
This is when Richard Nixon is still president.
Correct.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yes, 72. And it was a you know, a good thing for the country, a new experiment. And Marshfield wanted to try it. The clinic wanted to try it. And Blue Cross Blue Shield United was willing to come in to be a partner of ours on that, to do the insurance part of the business. St. Joseph's Hospital was willing to come in Marshfield to be the hospital component of it. And the Marshfield Clinic did most of the administration of the plan and certainly provided all the medical services when we started. Now, we had to contract out to other providers as the service area expanded, so we included other physicians in the community and surrounding areas.
Not physicians at that time who were members of the clinic staff?
Correct. Non-clinic physicians, because you've got to have doctors and hospitals taking care of patients if you're going to sell an insurance product. And if that contract for insurance is sold beyond your immediate footprint, you've got to have affiliated physicians and hospitals outside the immediate Marshfield area. That venture, I think, went well. There were stresses in the mid-80s when Blue Cross was having some problems with their computer conversion. And as any partnership, sometimes personalities change and strengths and weaknesses change. And in the old days when Leo Soicott and Gerard ran Blue Cross and Blue Shields, I think they were separate at that time, things went well. The clinic was pleased with it, the hospital was pleased with it, and I think Blue Cross was pleased with it, and provided care to a lot of people. And initially it was provided on a community basis, the premium was. So everyone got the same premium, which is a concept that Ben Lawton and Russ Lewis championed from within the clinic. That did not survive the test of reality financially, because as one company had better results than another one, the company with better results wanted a lower premium. So the driving force that really hurt community rating came from the business community. Anyway, in the mid-80s, the Blue Cross organization went through a very large computer reorganization. Ed Edwards was the president of the insurance company at that time, and he did a good job, and he was a good partner with us. But Blue Cross was clearly interested in some other issues at that time, and it hadn't grown as Blue Cross had probably thought it could or should. They had competing markets, competing products in the market to the our HMO. And ultimately, in 87, we had this dissolution of the Greater Marshfield Community Health Plan, the joint venture as we knew it. We established Security Health Plan at that time, in 1987. And actually, we had had a smaller HMO operation, Manitowoc, Two Rivers area. And that was a long ways from home, and is the clinic was growing, and people developed different interests. So ultimately what happened is Security Health Plan assumed the rollover of the contracts from Greater Marshfield. We agreed that we would dissolve the plan, and I was general counsel at that time. We did the drafting, and we got it all done, and Blue Cross helped us with the drafting. And it was a good conversion. And some of the reserves went to Blue Cross. The hospital was just getting paid their fees anyway, so they didn't have a huge investment in it. Mm-hmm. And the clinic took over the management of all the contracts, just an assumption of the contracts. And we managed what used to be Greater Marshfield Community Health Plan, and it was now becoming Security Health Plan of Wisconsin, Inc.
Did the clinic have to add staff at that time to manage all the contracts?
I think we added sales staff, certainly, and probably some more management staff, but not a great deal. People that had been with Blue Cross came over to us, like Chuck Payne, who was in sales, and Pete Mick. They were in sales at Greater Marshfield Community Health Plan, Blue Cross product. Mm-hmm. And they joined us, and we administered the HMO at that time. And the plan has grown. Right now, we've grown it to 183,000 enrollees, and the footprint is much larger than what it was in 1987.
Mm-hmm. Reed, one question about that dissolution. I take it that that was cordial. There was no acrimony.
No, it was cordial. Some long negotiations on where the money went. You know, I went to Blue Cross, but that was okay. It was time to move on. Mm-hmm. Everyone felt that. And so anyway, the staff, the actuarial staff, like Rob Amir, who's still with us, all came on to the clinic payroll at that time. And so it was seamless to the subscribers and patients. But Blue Cross was no longer selling this product. Security Health Plan was selling this product. And we had it separately incorporated in the state of Wisconsin and got separate tax-exempt status for Security Health Plan, which happened to be the same year that we got our 501c3 status for the Marshfield Clinic. We got the 501c4 status for Security Health Plan.
Which was based in the clinic.
Correct. Okay. Right. It was run out of the clinic down one of the quadrants. And, well, you probably remember the people that were running at that time. Dave Gruhl was instrumental in the conversion.
Yes.
And the establishment of the plan. So after that, Tom Hefty came in then, formerly Blue Cross's general counsel. He came in as president of the organization shortly after the computer conversion issues, and Ed Edwards left, and Tom took over.
And did you know Tom? I'm assuming you did.
Yes, I did. He used to be in the insurance commissioner's office, and we knew him, and we negotiated with him at length about this new venture that he wanted to put together with the Marshfield Clinic, basically piggybacking on the concept that we had had up until 1987 with the joint venture. We were not successful, though, in this venture, and Tom met with our executive committee at the time and was quite unhappy that we couldn't come to a conclusion on the contract.
What were the stumbling blocks?
Tom wanted a price equal to Security Health Plan at that time. He wanted us to sell Marshfield Clinic services at the same discount that Security Health Plan received.
I see.
And our thinking process always has been and continues to be, the more volume an insurance company brings to us, the more discount they can receive. But we deal with 600 different insurance companies. Mm-hmm. And it's only the people that bring a lot of volume that get a substantial discount. And Tom had an antitrust background before he came to Blue Cross in the insurance commissioner's office in Wisconsin. And he felt that perhaps this was the AT&T breakup case. You know, Marshfield Clinic was just too large. We were an essential facility, and the clinic needed to be broken up. Hmm. And is either he was going to negotiate with a couple of our regional clinics, he wanted us to sell Marshfield Clinic at different prices, depending on different regions. Well, Marshfield Clinic Integrated Delivery System has one fee schedule,
right,
for non-Medicare patients.
And Tom knew that, I'm
yes,
sure.
Yes, of course he did, yes. But I think he really wanted to do this major antitrust case in the health field. Just like, you know, AT&T is too big, you got to be broken up. So therefore, Judge Green wrote this, you know, the AT&T case.
Yeah, I remember.
And here we have all these baby bells around the countryside. So there were quite a few threats to the executive committee. Blue Cross's lawyer, which was Jim Troupas from Michael Best here in town, threatened a firestorm of litigation if the clinic did not accept the Blue Cross proposal. And it's intriguing that the firestorm was unleashed on Ash Wednesday, February 16th, 1994.
A point for your side, that you noted that.
Just a little bit of intrigue there.
When Blue Cross Blue Shield threatened a firestorm of litigation, what was their position, Reed? What did they say? You know, you note here, if the clinic did not accept the Blue Cross Blue Shield United proposal, was it basically take it or leave it?
Well, we negotiated at length about the proposal, and we met in Milwaukee. I remember Dick Lear and I went to Milwaukee to meet with the board about this, the Blue Cross board. Tom came up and met with our executive committee about this.
And Dick Lear is clinic president now?
At that time, yes. Basically, they wanted the contract. And really what was at heart of the whole thing was, does Blue Cross get the chance to dictate the terms of the contract, or does the group medical practice known as Marshfield Clinic, or the same principle could apply to a hospital, does the provider have something to say about the contract, or is the contract provided on a take-it-or-leave-it basis?
Okay.
Because you really have playing out here who controls the price of medicine. Because if the insurance companies can say, I will pay you 50% of your fee schedule, you lose all your negotiating room. You never, ever, ever have tertiary care centers in rural Wisconsin if that happens. You can't, because Tom's theory was what was reasonable as far as the fee schedule was what Blue Cross usual and customary was.
Okay.
And maybe one of the other burrs on the saddle was we used to balance bill the Blue Cross subscribers for the difference between what Blue Cross paid us and what our charge was. And it would bother the subscribers, but we had no contract with Blue Cross that said we were going to hold the patient or the insurance company harmless. So we always balance billed the patient, mm-hmm. and the patients would be unhappy and complain to Blue Cross, and that was a source of irritation.
I'm sure.
But I mean, we balance billed all of our patients that were covered by an insurance company. Now, an HMO concept is you don't balance bill because you agree to accept the reimbursement from the insurance company as payment, except for maybe deductibles and co-pays and things like that. So the complaint said, deep down, I think, that Marshfield Clinic had developed a monopoly in physician services. including HMO services. The monopoly served as a barrier for Blue Cross or any other competitors. Because he couldn't get a contract with us, he could not sell product, insurance product, in central, northern, western Wisconsin. He thought that we were charging excessive fees. He thought that this was a contract combination or conspiracy to unreasonably restrain trade because the provider controlled the insurance contract, which is kind of novel at the time. And his other argument was that the quality of the clinic staff made the clinic an essential facility, which is a legal term carried down from a railroad industry. That, I mean, you got to get on the track. You got to move your freight on this track. There's only one track. Therefore, the train is an essential facility. And there are extra rules and regulations on that, like a public utility concept that medicine is now a public utility, like an electrical line, and you got to regulate that and treat everyone to have access to that that wants to sell insurance.
Okay.
Those are the theories.
Okay. All right.
And this
is filed in federal court?
Yeah, the lawsuit was filed in February 1994 in federal district court in Madison here. Case was assigned to Judge Shabazz. And is important because there's a private competitor, not a public agency. Most antitrust enforcement comes from a public agency. Mm-hmm. Federal Trade Commission, Antitrust Division of Justice, or the State Attorney General's Office, breaking up the monopolies. This one was by a private competitor trying to enforce the contract, mm-hmm. with the monopoly theory. So that was the thrust of their complaint filed against us. The first we heard about the case, we started getting press inquiries that, this complaint in the press release from Blue Cross was given to every legislative office in the Capitol. Uh-huh. We had not yet been served. We didn't know the details of the complaint. But that's a good technique of a plaintiff's lawyer is to this firestorm of litigation, which includes a public relations campaign against the clinic, hoping that perhaps the reputation of the clinic is so dear and we want to preserve our goodwill that we would then give the contract that they were looking for.
Reed, when an aggrieved party files a lawsuit, like Blue Cross in this case, they are not obligated to give it to you at the same time?
Not when it goes into the court, no. It goes through a process of serving the complaint.
Okay.
Process server does that. And that can take up to 3 days, sometimes more. But once it's filed, it's a matter of public record with the court. And they can, file the complaint in every public relations forum they wish to accomplish their mission in. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we answered. We had had an antitrust review done shortly before this, sort of a due diligence thing by Jones Day, Revis, and Pogue out of Washington, D.C. We'd always relied on Phil Proger in that office for antitrust advice because we knew we were large, and we tried to be proactive in looking at where our possible exposure is. So we had Jones Day come in, and they told us they thought we were fine. We were large, but we're trying to be fair to everyone because, well, if you give Blue Cross a special deal, you got to then give all your insurance companies a special deal. Mm-hmm. And this was part of the thinking process at that time also was government programs are paying less and less of your cost. If you're going to stay in business, you got to pass some of those extra costs onto the private insurance business. Mm-hmm. That's just every institution in the United States does the same thing. Mm-hmm. Medicare and Medicaid pay us 50% of our costs, not our charges, our costs. And for us to stay in business, you have to charge a little more than your cost to the other insurance companies or private pay patients. Mm-hmm. So we denied the allegations, but we were in federal district court, and here we are. We're talking April of 1994. Jury trial set for December of 1994 on a major, major federal antitrust lawsuit. Mm-hmm. But Judge Shabazz runs a very fast docket, sometimes known as the rocket docket. And it was, so that summer, 94, was devoted to depositions and discovery.
And Reed, are you doing the bulk of the work at this point?
No, we brought in Jones Day. We needed a litigation firm
that
specialized in antitrust. So Jones Day brought in a couple of associates and went through documents. We produced over 100,000 pages of documents. Several people, organizations we deal with, got subpoenas for documents, other hospitals. I don't know how many depositions were conducted. I never did count them all. But the summer of 94 was devoted to antitrust litigation. I mean, that's all we did, between setting up depositions, producing documents. And you had to open your files and produce documents. And when you have 100,000 pages, there's going to be some things in there that you're not real proud of, which unfolded in this case. One of the ways that you shortcut litigation is you move for summary judgment. Say, you know, there's really nothing here for the jury to decide. This can be decided on legal paper. And we made that motion, no distinct HMO market. We had offered CompCare reasonable access, and we had stretched things quite a ways to give them a good contract, but it wasn't acceptable.
Reed, what does Blue Cross lacking standing mean exactly?
We thought that something of this nature should be brought by the public enforcers, the agencies. And Blue Cross can't show that they've really been hurt here, because they can balance, you know, they sell their product, they get paid their usual fee, we balance bill. So they don't have a aggrievement. They aren't aggrieved in this. They're made whole, was our argument. And it really should have been the public agencies that were bringing this case to enforce an antitrust matter, federal antitrust matter, rather than a private competitor.
Reed, as a professional matter, you're still general counsel for the clinic.
Right.
Are you besieged on a pretty regular basis by clinic physicians wanting to know what's happening, seeking reassurance? Or were you and the lawyers and the executive committee pretty much left alone to deal with this?
No, this had a huge newsworthy components to it. And everyone, especially the people that had to give depositions or produce files, it took a lot of attention of the clinic that summer. Mm-hmm. We were communicating regularly with the shareholders and the board of directors in our communities.
Okay.
And our press releases, our conversations with the press said, we still think we're okay, and we're defending this case vigorously, is what our concept was. Well, Judge Shabazz did not accept our summary judgment motion on July 5. He said these are all material facts for the jury. And we made another motion in September of 1994, summary judgment motion, legal arguments, no barriers to entry of new physicians. I mean, we had a lot of physicians, but we did not have all the physicians, certainly, in the marketplace. The clinic lacks market power in any meaningful physician service market. We've acted consistently with legitimate competition. We have not conspired. And again, Judge Shabazz says, you know what, I can't dismiss the case. This is something that the jury's got to decide.
So Judge Shabazz's decision is only an affirmation of the process that this has to go to the jury.
Right. And some judges will issue summary judgment on things like that. Judge Shabazz chose not to.
Okay.
So here we are, December 12th, April to December. 8 months later, we're in federal district court in Madison at Christmas time.
Yeah.
Quite an imposition on all the witnesses, imposition on the jurors, and is a small jury pool to choose from. Most people were gone that were associated with the university, so we had a smaller pool of people. And December 12 to 16, the plaintiff had the case presented. We had between December 27 and 30 to present our case. And I mean, you got the Christmas break in there. It was not an ideal time mm-hmm. for a jury to hear a very complex antitrust case. Mm-hmm. And antitrust law is very complex.
Yes.
Friday, December 30th, we got this very bad jury verdict here in Madison. It was early evening, I remember it. I was waiting for the jury to come in, and basically the jury answered everything yes that the plaintiffs asked for, right down the line, right down the line.
Were you surprised, Reed?
I was surprised, yeah. I wasn't shocked, given how things went, but it's very easy for them just to say yes. Blue Cross established product in geographic markets, which was a key legal point. We possessed monopoly power. We engaged in anti-competitive conduct. We attempted to monopolize. We conspired. We entered into contracts to unreasonably restrain trade. We conspired. Purpose was to unreasonably restrain trade. And we allegedly violated Chapter 13304 of the Wisconsin statute. So, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. I mean, that's a terrible drive home from Madison that night, back to Marshfield.
You were alone?
I was alone, and it's like, you know, we had been hit, the entire clinic had been hit with this medical malpractice case, everyone, because now we were conspirators, and we had monopolized the physician trade, and it was all illegal. Everything that the clinic had built was illegal. But we have to go back for a damage verdict. This is the determination on whether we were liable or not.
Reed, before you get into that, the jury, you've already said a small jury pool. Were you present for the selection of the jury?
Right.
And what did you feel? Were you apprehensive after the jury was seated?
I was. Concept being that this is a very complex legal argument, I don't think anyone had a college education.
Ah. Okay.
And for something like this to be understood by a jury, it's a very complex thing to do. So that's why I think it was so convenient to answer yes to everything.
Okay.
It did not instill the thinking process that I thought would be necessary. So, we go back, and you know, this jury's a runaway jury now, and damage verdict came in on January 4th. I think maybe a little over a day trial for that. And obviously the jury now was believing everything that the Blue Cross lawyers were trying to prove and nothing that we were trying to prove in defense. Same thing, they ignored our witnesses. They ignored our damage experts. So we've got a $10.5 million judgment to Blue Cross against us, and a $5.669 judgment to CompCare, their HMO. And after trebling, which happens, now the jury didn't know this, but in antitrust cases, damages are trebled. So all of a sudden, we're waking up and we got a $48.5 million judgment against us. Huge, huge jury verdict against us.
And that was all over the press, I assume.
Everywhere. Everywhere. two of the jurors wrote to the judge and said, basically, you tricked us. You never told us what the about the trebling. We did not want that kind of a verdict against the Marshfield Clinic. Well, see, they aren't advised that there's treble damages. So Judge Shabazz says, you know, that's too bad. That's the way the law is. But I think a couple of the jurors showed remorse about the size of the verdict, because $48.5 million is an awful lot of money on something
yes.
like this.
Did they communicate that concern to you, or did
judge? No, it only went to the judge. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be able to communicate. We were not able to communicate with them. They just communicated with the judge. They wrote after the fact. And so anyway, we've got this situation on our hands. It's January 4. We've got to file an appeal bond by February 1. Appeal bonds allow you to appeal the case to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And if you can't post appeal bond, you can't appeal. Now, this is the largest appeal bond in Wisconsin history at the time. And you got to have cash. You got to have people that are saying, yeah, Marshall Clinic's good for this. Tough thing to come up with at the time because so much of our resource, our accounts receivable, were all pledged to bonds.
Mm-hmm.
See, you know, one of the things we learned is you got to keep some of your accounts receivable, some of your assets free. You don't tie them all up on your bond projects mm-hmm. because you never know when you need extra cash. But we were scrambling, there's no question. Motions after verdict were not successful. Fortunately, the appeal bond was awarded. We got it together. Ron Vanderstil and I and a bunch of other people worked very hard to get that together. And you could tell who your banker friends are because no one wanted to come to our rescue. And our big banks we deal with out in New York said, well, ministry should come forward and help out on this.
Ministry being?
The St. Joseph's Hospital.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, the bankers were falling away because they thought they were lending into litigation.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to support this. Well, we had some cash in the Security Health Fund, quite a bit of cash, separate in the Security Health Fund. We were able to get that together. We got an appeal bond together, finally, through offshore, someone that used to be at Wausau Insurance out of San Francisco, Farman's Fund, as I remember. But during this time, January of 95 now, we were looking at a lot of different alternatives. Blue Cross wished to settle the case. Obviously, they wanted to settle right away.
Yeah, sure.
We wanted to appeal the case. And Tim Cullen came, one of our trial lawyers from Washington came. Steve Callum from Madison came up, too, and talked to our board and our shareholders and did a really nice job.
Callum being one of your lawyers.
Right. He was a trial lawyer from Madison here. And but the trial defense was handled by the antitrust lawyers out of Washington, D.C.,
What did Tim Cullen say to the board?
Totally unexpected. He said we need to appeal this because we think we can overturn this case. But Steve Callum he came up right away. Tim couldn't come right away. And the board, of course, was very uneasy. All the doctors were very uneasy. We were all uneasy.
Yeah.
We had sources of revenue. We could have sold part of the Security Health Plan, but he changed the clinic overnight to work for so many, many years and have to part with $48.5 million or even half of that on the settlement would have been quite detrimental to the clinic.
Mm-hmm.
We had some bad documents. Some of our guys wrote some bad documents that no one was proud of
mm-hmm.
after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
They're just kind of cowboy documents.
Uh-huh.
Didn't help us. So we had two documents ready. When we filed the appeal bond. If we couldn't get the appeal bond together, we were going to have to file a bankruptcy petition just to protect the assets of the clinic, to stay the enforcement. As Blue Cross refused to stay enforcement, they would not voluntarily reduce the need for an appeal bond or the amount of the appeal bond.
Oh, they're playing hardball.
Really hardball to try and force a settlement. And they thought they were in the catbird seat at that time. I mean, they got a yes to every one of their questions. I mean, seemed open and shut to them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were able to get that appeal bond together, which allowed us to take the matter forward. We made some motions after verdict that Judge Shabazz did not support at all. But on March 22nd, 1995, after we filed our appeal bond, we had some motions after verdict, and Judge Shabazz reduced the verdict by $31 million. Now, if that would have happened before we filed our appeal bond, the appeal bond would have been so very, very, very much easier to procure. instead of $40.5 million, you can reduce $31 million from it, and that's the appeal bond you needed to put together.
And one, why did Shabazz not do it earlier? And two, does the judge, in a case where antitrust requires a trebling of damages, still have the authority to reduce the?
Yes, yes, they can. But just because of the timing and other issues, we were forced to file the appeal bond. The judge would not give us any relief on that. And but anyway, we got it together. And but then there was a good day in the clinic on March 22nd. And I think maybe things started to turn around right when we got the appeal bond together, because then we knew we were going up on the Seventh Circuit. And enforcement was stayed because I think the bankruptcy petition was Plan B, because I know Blue Cross was going to replevin our checking accounts and our payroll accounts and everything else. And just to continue the operations of the clinic, we would have had to file a bankruptcy petition. So we had that prepared. Fortunately, we didn't have to file it because we got the appeal bond together. And but Shabazz called the jury award of damages monstrously excessive. And as I said, reduced the $10.5 million to Blue Cross down to $595,000, and the CompCare award was reduced to just a little over $5 million, which this is all manageable now as far as an appeal goes. He also issued an injunctive relief order on that day, and Blue Cross had wanted us to divest some of our regional clinics or a security health plan, which, of course, Blue Cross would have picked up at fire sale prices.
Yes.
And you know, one of the things that bothered me, Ministry would play the same game. They would have offered to buy our joint venture lab portion, you know, our lucrative lines of business at fire sale prices to help us out.
Bud used to talk about the hospital.
Yes, okay. So they also wanted a most favored nation clause for their insurance products. That was not granted. There were certain agreements we had that were voided. We were prohibited from violating the antitrust laws, which of course we weren't going to do. We could not discriminate against Blue Cross. We could not have any super competitive pricing, and that was not defined at that time. Mm-hmm. Blue Cross had the right then to develop what they thought was super competitive pricing. We had to put a compliance program together, certified compliance with all the publications and everything else. And that order would have expired on March 22, 1998, so we would have been under this injunction from 95 to 98. And, you know, with the $31 million reduced, we knew that Marshfield Clinic was surviving at that time, no question. But here we go up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago, which handles appeals from judgments that are erroneous or errors in law that have been committed by the judge from the state of Wisconsin and Illinois and some other jurisdictions.
Reed, a question about the clinic. I've forgotten. Is Fritz Wenzel still executive director or president?
At this time, no.
Okay, he had left.
Yes, he was a witness for us, but he had left at that time. Bob DeVita was executive director. Bill Mino was, and Jim Coleman were helping to run this security health plan at that time. Those are the three main witnesses, and it turned out that their documents were the most damning, and we'll go into that when we get to the Seventh Circuit.
Okay.
So we filed our notice of appeal on April 21, 1995. And we ask for a motion for stay of the injunction pending appeal. And to prove that to the Seventh Circuit, you've got to have a strong showing of a likelihood of success. You got to show irreparable injury. You got to show lack of substantial injury to the other parties. And we said, okay, well, all of our assets are in Wisconsin. We aren't going anyplace. We've been around since 1916. And we said that was in the public interest. Judge Posner, writing for Judge Posner, Bauer, and Kahn, and Of course, Posner is a noted national antitrust scholar. Very well written, many books on these issues. Very well recognized in the antitrust area. He granted the stay of the injunction on May 18, 1995. Now that was also just before, I think one day before, we had to certify to Judge Shabazz that we were in compliance with his injunction. And the day before this, the General Counsel at Blue Cross defined super-competitive pricing in her documents with the court as anything over Blue Cross's 50th percentile of usual and customary. And then the next day, the injunction stayed. It was a happy day for us.
Very. Reed, you say here a strong showing of likelihood of success. So not only did you get the stay, but is there a suggestion of a message from the Seventh Circuit that you might very well win your case?
Of course. That's what that stay meant to us. And that's one of the legal tests is we're going to win it. So why force us to go through this injunction and change all of our policies and procedures? So we had put together a very strong antitrust compliance program at the time that we were ready to roll forward. The only thing that we could not possibly comply with is super competitive pricing was anything above our Blue Cross's 50th percentile, because that's exactly what they wanted. They wanted to tell us what we could charge.
Correct.
And we also know that threats had been made against the other large clinics in the state that you're next. After I get done with Marshfield, you're next. So, I mean, all of a sudden you got Blue Cross Blue Shield controlling all the contracts in the state of Wisconsin, which I don't think would have been healthy for anyone except Blue Cross. So Judge Posner took the case on, which we were pleased with. And we had a June 5th opening brief to be filed. Blue Cross had until July 5th. They got that moved to July 20. After Blue Cross's initial brief was rejected by the court as to form, we responded then by July 19. And the court, you could tell, had a personal interest in this because of the magnitude of the case in the country at this time. Mm-hmm. And the antitrust issues. And the court, on its own motion, expedited the appeal on May 22.
Are you getting a lot of national press attention on this?
Oh, yeah, clearly. I mean, a lot. I mean, when we lost, we were down $48.5 million. That made huge national attention. And we said at the time, we're going to appeal this to the U.S. Supreme Court if we have to, because we don't think this is fair. Mm-hmm. And we were on that track. The court also scheduled oral arguments in late July or early August. No extensions of time will be granted. So, I mean, you talk about a no-nonsense judicial calendar. Posner said, this is going to be on a fast track. I want to get this done. So the appeal is filed in April, and initial briefs filed. Ours is June 5th. And we said the plaintiff established neither markets nor power. There are no HMO service markets. We have no power in physician services markets. That's illegal. That was our argument. These are legal arguments. We said they failed to prove its essential facilities claim. They cannot recover for alleged overcharges. They failed to prove the amount of its damages. And their experts were a little slippery, let's put it that way, in my judgment. And the district court granted improper injunctive relief. Now, the friends of the court, amicus curiae briefs were coming in. The AGPA filed a friend of the court brief on our behalf, MGMA, the American Medical Association, the state
and
medical.
And AG is group practice?
American Group Practice Association, yes. So we're getting a lot of national attention. People started to finally figure out that this has to do with, do clinics, hospitals have the right to contract? Or do the insurance companies determine the contract term, especially if you're large? Blue Cross had some friends, too. Health Insurance Association of America filed a friend of the court brief, and Blue Cross Blue Shield Association National out of Chicago tried to file a brief, but it's rejected by the court. I said, no, you can't file that. So a lot of little flags coming up that this was going okay for us at the time. Oral arguments were heard on August 9th, and of course we went down for that to listen to these oral arguments. And you can tell Posner is a very, very articulate questioner of lawyers. And Tim handled himself well. Cullen handled the argument. Steve Callum went down with us. And I didn't think Jim Troupas did as well as Tim Cullen at the time. Troupas was not prepared to answer the questions that Judge Posner asked.
So Tim is working for you?
Tim Cullen was the guy from Jones Day.
Who's oh, it's not the Tim Cullen I'm thinking of.
No. Tim Cullen is a trial lawyer from Jones Day out of Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay.
He specializes in antitrust law.
Okay.
So September 18, 1995, again, a very important day for us, a day that I'll never forget. He said Security Health Plan is not a monopolist. There's no separate HMO market. No contemporary principle of antitrust law can justify the jury's finding that a separate HMO market exists. Okay, well, this is one of the things that we raised in June of the year before on our first summary judgment motion, or July. We said, these are legal things. They can't file a claim on these theories. It's not legally correct. Mm-hmm. Judge Shabazz did not see that, but Judge Posner did. And, I mean, those are fundamental jurisdiction cases. The case should have been dismissed on the legal grounds back the summer before. There should not have ever been a jury award or jury trial. It should have been dismissed on legal grounds there, okay? But those are things that Posner understands from an antitrust standpoint, and Judge Shabazz did not.
I thought Shabazz was a pretty sharp guy. Is he not?
Well, I think he made some mistakes and was overturned entirely on this case. He's sharp, of course. You know, he's served the judiciary well, but I think he missed a couple things on this as history unfolded, as Posner has taught us now. Posner said Marshfield Clinic is not a monopolist. The quality of clinic doctors does not make the clinic monopoly. Generally, you must pay more for higher quality. We do not control independent doctors in the marketplace. We have no monopoly of physician services other than in areas too small to support a handful of physicians. We may be a natural monopoly just because we're the only doctors in Marshfield, but that has to do with our quality, not because we're driving our competition out of business.
Yeah.
One of the quotes we liked was at page 1412. If an entire county has only 12 physicians, one can hardly expect or want them to set up a competitive practice with each other. We live in the age of technology and specialization in medical services. Physicians practice in groups and alliances and networks, utilizing expensive equipment and support. 12 physicians competing in a county would be competing to provide horse and buggy medicine. Only as part of a large and sophisticated medical enterprise such as Marshfield Clinic can they practice modern medicine in rural Wisconsin. I think he's referring to our Ladysmith Center with this reference. Say we're not an essential facility. We do not control even 50% of any properly defined markets, and that's the definition. You know, you've got to define the market correctly. The suggestion that being the price of being best is to be brought under the regulatory aegis of antitrust law and stripped of your power to decide whom to do business with does not identify an interest that the antitrust laws protect. We liked that phrase, too.
I'm sure you did.
Blue Cross wanted us to provide cross-coverage obligations to anyone that wanted them. Mm-hmm. Public utility, basically.
Uh-huh.
Clinic maintains a reputation for high quality by being selective about the physicians to whom it entrusts its customers. CompCare is not entitled to recover any damages. Blue Cross has standing. Posner is a great author. His prose is magnificent. He referenced Blue Cross's claim that the clinic colluded with competitors to raise prices. says there are various furbelows and arabesques that can be ignored. He said this claim fails most favored nation clause acknowledged by the court, which later got the attention of the Justice Department. He did concentrate on the agreement of competitors to divide markets. He felt that there was some evidence from our clinic documents. He said the evidence is a little scanty, but sufficient to sustain the verdict on this and only this aspect of the case. So we did not get off entirely free. Mm-hmm. He said we did have evidence of division of markets, and we had some hot documents, if you will.
Are those the ones that were problematical?
Yes, they were. Right, yeah. Judge Posner referred to that, and we knew that they were, but we had to produce them. We couldn't destroy them, of course. It wouldn't be possible. It's just your obligation to the court. He said there's got to be a new injunction written in from scratch, and neither the court's invalidating most of it. But except for the prohibition on dividing markets with competing groups, the rest of the injunction falls with the charges that the court held to be without legal or factual basis, which Judge Shabazz should have recognized, we felt, the summer before. No part of the award of damages or of cost and attorney fees can stand because these items were not segregated by offense. So instead of $48.5 million, they're down to zero. It's a good day for the clinic.
Yes. Were there a group of you down for this decision from the
No, clinic? This was handed down from the bench, and we read it in our offices.
Oh, okay.
We were not there when this was handed out. I wasn't there anyway. Interesting, a new trial for damages for dividing markets, but it's the burden on Blue Cross to show how much less it would have paid the clinic had the clinic refrained from that practice. And he's scolding the judge here. He says the bench and bar of the Seventh Circuit should not imitate the special verdict on liability that Judge Shabazz sent to the jury, which just simply allowed you to answer yes to all the questions. They were invited to give rote answers rather than forcing the jurors to think, is what Judge Posner wrote. And the case is remanded, but importantly, it's given to a new judge. It's taken away from Shabazz. It's Judge Crabb now is to be assigned to the judge. Cost of the appeal to the clinic. So it's even getting better. Mm-hmm. We got our cost. Justice and Federal Trade Commission asked for clarification of Posner's decision. They did not like the most favored nation clause. That's something that they have fought against for a long time. It wasn't really a critical thing to us. But Posner wrote a couple sentences, four sentences, which clarified it, and everyone was happy except Blue Cross then. Blue Cross asked that Rule 36, a new judge on remand, not apply. That was denied quickly. Motion to stay mandate and release the appeal bond granted by the Seventh Circuit November 8th. Well, we had to put a lot of money aside in non-interest-bearing accounts to support this appeal. So those were released back to us. So we could then at least have this money on interest again.
Uh-huh. No. Reed, are you hearing anything informally from Tom Hefty at all during this?
No, everything was handled by Jim Chupas at that time.
Okay.
We had no communication with Hefty that I remember anyway at this time. So Blue Cross is unhappy. They filed a petition with this U.S. Supreme Court for a writ of certiorari to appeal this.
Reed, I've forgotten what a writ of certiorari.
It means that you got to review this because the Seventh Circuit Court made a mistake here. Writ of certiorari is they're going to review the record.
Okay.
We filed our brief in opposition on February 15, and okay, well now this has got national attention, a lot of national attention. There is an amicus curiae brief filed in support of Blue Cross petition from the Wisconsin Attorney General, which is our current governor at the time. And he had put together a team of 25 other states filing a motion to have this overturned at the Supreme Court. Now, that's not good for us because having states ask that the matter be overturned draws a lot of attention to this to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that means that maybe they're going to grant the certiorari and review the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were quite unhappy with Attorney General Doyle and his staff for leading this charge, but I mean, they had not been involved in the case in any way, shape, or form in trial. I'm sure they were following it, but nowhere to be seen. And then when it goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court, they're asking, there was an error here, this injustice where that jury award was kicked out by this guy Posner has got to be overturned.
Why did Doyle do that, Reed? What's your guess? Or perhaps you know.
I don't know. I have some speculation. There may have been some political pressure put on him, because Blue Cross is certainly an influential group in the state of Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why they did that, but it's could have possibly hurt us a great deal.
Indeed.
Have our Attorney General doing that. But at the same time, I know that we had a bond project going, and the Attorney General is supposed to sign off on those. It's a matter of routine.
Oh.
Always. Never had a problem before. We go to have the Attorney General sign off it on the day before closing. He refuses. Unheard of. Political influence, I think. So, I know I don't have enough friend in Judge Doyle. Attorney General Doyle at this time. He's trying to hurt us with that, too. Mm-hmm. We had to track the governor, Tommy Thompson, down in Jordan. He was over there on a trade mission. And actually, when he was gone, Scott McCallum was lieutenant governor. He was acting. He signed for us. So we got around it, and we were able to close on our bond deal. But again, just appeared that maybe there's a little influence there. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court denied the writ on March 18, 1996. So the case is remanded back to Federal District Court, assigned to Judge Crabb on March 27, 1996.
Also, for the record, it's worth noting that she, too, is an alum of the UW.
Yes, I know that. So now we're doing motions again to try and narrow the case down, and Comcare is no longer a party. She was very clear that Blue Cross must prove damages it sustained as a result of the inappropriate allocation of markets, and told them how they had to do that. There has to be a nexus between the damages and the illegal activity. Injunctive relief order issued on September 10, 1996. Basically, she said, you guys got to follow the law. And of course, there's no question. She ordered voiding and enjoining any agreements concerning allocation of customers, territories, products, or service markets, which is right out of the statute. She allowed us to enter into lawful agreements. But we had to distribute the order to North Central Health Protection Plan, which is one of those groups that we divided markets with, as Judge Posner found. All physicians in the city of Wausau, the Rhinelander Medical Center, Gunderson Clinic, Rice Clinic, and Ministry Corporation. Because there was some evidence in the file that perhaps we divided markets with those organizations, she said. So therefore, send them the order so they know that you can't divide markets. Well, it's embarrassing, but no problem. We filed a motion for summary judgment in February of 1997. We said the Blue Cross damages that they've filed do not link to the findings entered by the first jury. They did not prove antitrust injury. They have not disaggregated those injuries attributed to legal factors versus illegal factors. And they were claiming damages for administrative services only and self-insured contracts. So they were trying to paint with a broad brush. April 1, 1997. Okay. Jury verdict in December of 1994. We're 3 years down the road, 2.5 years down the road now. Judge Crabb writes, it appears from the expert's reports that plaintiff has filed in preparation for the new trial on damages that it views as a magnanimous invitation, the small window of opportunity left it by the Court of Appeals and by the September 10, 1996 order from her. Far from taking the $594,000 plus in damages as a starting point, they went far, far beyond it. They tried to prove damages from scratch, which the new definition of markets and two wholly new constructs of damages amounting to more than $7 million. Mm-hmm. So they were taking another huge kick at the cat, mm-hmm. not happy at all with the 594 that they had from the first jury trial. Not surprisingly, defendants finds this objectionable, she writes.
Is that what she wrote, yeah, not surprisingly?
That's right, yeah. So she further defined that. I guess there's not much sense in going through all that. But she said again, plaintiffs must prove that the defendant's market division was a material element of some injury to the plaintiff and a substantial factor in producing that injury. Plaintiffs must make a just and reasonable estimate of the amount of those damages. But they were taking a wide cut hit or trying to swing wide there. Damages must be disaggregated to account for factors. So they had to prove what our illegal activities caused them in damages. There has to be a chain of events there. So it is difficult not to view plaintiff's experts, and this was Byard McGuire, with a jaundiced eye, given the huge discrepancies between the current damage calculations and those offered at the first trial.
Who are Byard and McGuire?
Those were two expert consultants that Blue Cross retained. Experts on damages, allegedly, that they were trying to prove the damage that Blue Cross experienced. Uh-huh. And it was a very hard argument to follow what they came up with in their damage calculations.
Okay.
They calculated damages resulting from market division 7 times higher than the damages caused by market divisions together with monopoly price fixing and other illegal acts. Post hoc ergo propter hoc is not a valid methodology of damage calculation, i.e. you can't just throw it all on the wall and hope some of it sticks. Uh-huh. You got to prove what flows from damages, from the illegal activity. She said Byers and McGuire's reports were inadmissible because they do not distinguish between contributions to defendants' increased prices and the legal and illegal conduct. Well, that was a huge blow to Blue Cross because here we are, we're getting pretty close to the new jury trial. And I think the jury trial was set for April 14 of 97. And here on the 1st of April, she's thrown out their damage experts. Mm-hmm. So what can they possibly prove now?
And why are they going ahead, do you think? They've gotten one blow after another.
They came all the way from $48.5 million down to zero. Mm-hmm. They had to recover something, I think, just a matter of pride.
Okay, so it comes down to the classic saving face?
Yeah, I think so. Plus, you know, they had this wonderful jury verdict that was all overturned. So, we were on the phone, just arguing some things just before the trial was to start 1 week later. This is April 7th. And the conversation with Judge Crabb was going on quite well. And with these damage experts being thrown out, Tim Cullen suggested on the phone that we should make a motion. Well, actually, she asked him, are you making a motion for summary judgment at this time to have the case thrown out? And Tim says, yes, that's what I'm doing. We're moving for summary judgment today. Plaintiff has no evidence that can introduce a trial that would enable the jury to make an informed decision about the amount of damages since the damage experts were tossed.
Uh-huh.
Amount of damages, if any, that has suffered from the antitrust violations. They had 19 months in which to consider the implication of the Court of Appeals decision. That they put all their eggs into one basket is not the fault of the defendants or any of the three courts that have dealt with this case. Clerk of Courts is directed to enter judgment for defendants and close this case. Again, a very, very, very good day for the Marshfield Clinic, which was April 7th, 1997. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they came out with zero at this time, absolute zero, because they were greedy, I think, looking back on it. We had a settlement position before this that was ready to settle this case for something, not anything substantial, but all of a sudden we're there and we won the whole thing. Mm-hmm. In fact, we got $132,000 in cost because of how things unfolded. So we're getting money from Blue Cross. Well, this is not setting well with Blue Cross. July 28th, she reaffirmed her April 7th summary judgment motion. The September 10 injunction was vacated because Blue Cross was unable to show any actual injury. Their motion for attorney fees and costs was denied, and the case was closed on August 1. Well, of course, Blue Cross is crushed here. So they filed an appeal up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals.
Reed, did you and your colleagues, following the July 28th decision, think that that would be the end of it? Or were you anticipating an appeal?
Yeah, they had too much invested in the case. They had millions invested, out-of-pocket cost, mm-hmm. in attorney fees and cost. I thought they'd appeal. They had to exhaust that last avenue. She reaffirmed, we got October 7 decision. We got an additional $88,000 award to the clinic in cost. Blue Cross was ordered to file an appeal bond in the amount of $220,000, which is a lot less than what we had to pay. But, I mean, the whole concept is it was fair. And June 5th, 1998, oral arguments regarding Blue Cross's appeal of Judge Crabb's decision to throw the whole thing out was heard. Now, July 30, 1998, again, the Seventh Circuit says no new trial on damages. Judge Posner, who had the case again, affirmed Judge Crabb's April 7th summary judgment decision. She had a right to throw out the damage claim because no reasonable jury could estimate damages from the reports of plaintiff's experts. I mean, their experts were not well received by the court, either Judge Crabb or Posner. Therefore, after 5 years of litigation, Blue Cross was able to prove any part of the payments that they made to the clinic were the result of acts that violated the antitrust laws. She did issue a new injunction, Judge Crabb was reversed on the issue of a new injunction. They said Blue Cross entitled to an injunction prohibiting division of markets with competitors, and again he quoted the bad documents that had been at the jury trial. He said they have a right to claim part of those damages because of those bad documents. So Blue Cross is still not happy. They go up to the U.S. Supreme Court again. So that's not enough. Not enough. So they filed a petition for a writ of certiorari on November 23rd, 1998. We said we'll file a response if the court wants one, which is an aggressive posture to take. The writ of cert was denied on January 11, 1999. So we're back in Judge Crabb's court in February of 1999. Judge Crabb issues a injunctive relief order, basically saying the same thing she said before. You cannot violate the antitrust laws. You can't divide markets, etc. Basically the same language, same distribution. Judge Crabb rejected Blue Cross's attempt to enjoin the clinic from enforcing its restrictive covenant. What Blue Cross wanted several times in the litigation was you cannot force doctors to stay with the Marshfield Clinic. If they want to break away from you and set up independent practice and contract with us, you gotta let them do it. Well, no one left the clinic during this period of time. No one left, which we were very pleased with. It shows the strength of the clinic. Mm-hmm. At that time. I don't know if that would be the case today, at that time, I think that's one of the things I was the most pleased with, is the fact that no one left the Marshfield Clinic. The injunction was written for 3 years, which is thou shalt not violate the law for 3 years. Well, what are we going to do after 3 years? We're not going to violate the law. We've got enough scrutiny on us now. Well, so they have the right to claim a part of their legal fees as damages related to the divisional markets that they were able to prove. Blue Cross tried to swing with the, or paint with a very broad brush again. The net result after all was said and done was $654,000 awarded Blue Cross for attorney fees.
Wow.
And I assume that they spent somewhere between $5 and $10 million on attorney fees.
Uh-huh.
So it was not a very good investment for them.
Because
I know what I had to pay for attorney fees and damage experts if they find out. We settled the case with Blue Cross on April 12th, 1999. Satisfaction of judgment was filed. And what Blue Cross had done when they got their big award was they filed that judgment in every county we do business with. Again, public relations issues, trying to embarrass the clinic. I mean, the clerk of courts talk. I mean, this is big news in the local courts in northern, western, central Wisconsin. So, I mean, we had the satisfaction of judgment, and Blue Cross was forced to file the satisfaction in every county that they'd filed their judgment in. But not the end of the story. Class action lawsuits started coming in, trying to piggyback on the Blue Cross litigation. And the first one was Rosema versus Marshfield Clinic. Now, this goes back, rolling back history to 1996. The Blue Cross case was finally removed, and my outline goes through the Blue Cross case, and we roll back in history to the Rosema case, filed attempting to show, well, if Blue Cross was hurt, then, you know, all the other insurance companies and all the other private pay patients, all your patients paid too much. If Blue Cross was hurt, then everyone did. And, of course, this comes out with the class action plaintiff's lawyers and their bar. First, they wanted to consolidate with Blue Cross litigation, which Judge Crabb rejected. And I think Blue Cross's lawyers were part of this attempt to try and consolidate the cases.
Uh-huh.
Crabb said the cases are substantially different. Yeah, we didn't really want all the other patients we've ever seen to be in a class action tied to the Blue Cross litigation. So, we got Rosema filed on July 24, 1996. And then a couple other groups of plaintiff's lawyers. Halita was the lead plaintiff's counsel, or lead plaintiff on that. They said, let's enjoin Rhinelander Medical Center and North Central Health Protection Plan because we divided markets with them. They could have included the Ministry Corporation, too. That class action, trying to piggyback on Blue Cross, was filed August 23rd, 1996. Very similar. Then Malik came in on November 14, 1996. So you feel like you're really being piled on here. Yeah. Everyone says, well, me too. There's easy money here.
Yes.
And then, of course, this is before we had won the whole thing. So they felt that they had a kick at the cat. So we got three class action lawsuits filed against us. They were all consolidated, so we only had to defend one case. This was consolidated by Judge Crabb in 1997. And we filed motions saying that they don't have standing, they can't certify a class that would be appropriate. There were lawyers out of Seattle, Washington as part of the lawyers on this case. They're just coming in from the country, lawyers that specialize in class actions. The court on July 18th said, you know, I share defendants' concern regarding plaintiff's ability to prove an overriding conspiracy. But she did establish a class. Didn't say there were damages, but she established a class. All purchases purchasers of physician services from defendants, the Marshfield Clinic, Security Health Plan, Rylander Medical Center, North Central Health Protection Plan, residing and purchasing physician services in 8 counties. Well, so we aren't done with the case. We go back into discovery on a whole new set of lawsuits. Blue Cross certainly had an influence on this.
So this, now let's see, Reed, the case had been settled in 1999.
Right.
So you don't have a final settlement when this is going
on? No. They were trying to just rely on all the documents and everything else that Blue Cross had tried to prove. And what hurt us here was that Rylander Medical Center got nervous, North Central Health Protection Plan got nervous, and they settled. They were defendants, but they settled out from underneath us on the case. Rylander paid $57,500, North Central paid $625,000. They were much more nervous than we were. And so now they're starting to cooperate with the plaintiffs, which is part of the settlement. But they were seeing big dollar judgments against them at this time.
Mm-hmm.
Which what they did is they funded the litigation against us then with those settlements. So we had to file a notice of class members sent out September 12, 1997. Approximately 250,000 names and addresses provided to the plaintiffs. And this is not good for our reputation. This is not good for patients of the Marshfield Clinic, telling them that this class action is out there. About 140,000 notices went out. 9,338 people opted out, said they didn't want anything to do with it. We got a partial summary judgment in October of 97. Sooner or later, the matter got settled, and we just felt, okay, we've come to the end here. Fortunately, we had an Aetna D&O policy, $10 million case,
mm-hmm.
$10 million policy that paid all of our legal fees during this thing.
Oh.
That was critical, because if we didn't have that, we would have had to settle. And I think that's probably the best thing Ron Vanderstone and I ever did, was pick up that D&O policy before the Blue Cross case came in. So we knew how much we were going to have to pay to defend the case. We agreed to pay $4 million, half from Aetna, half from us, $2 million. So we had to come up with $2 million, which was no big shakes after being down 48 and a half. But the money didn't go to the patients. It went to the lawyers, as always. And under the Cypre doctrine, it went to some charitable foundations rather than individual class members. I think if they would have gone to individual class members, people would have gotten a check for a buck and a half. We had to enter another agreement, basically. This one was for 6 years. We agreed not to raise our fees, which we've never done more than the CPI anyway, so that wasn't a big thing. We had to maintain our level of uncompensated charity care. That was no problem, because just to preserve our C3, we have to do that. A couple other things on cross coverage that weren't really that important. No one could serve Ministry Health Corp for a period of 4 years as a director of ministry. Well, Fred Westbrook had to resign from the ministry board, but that was no big deal. We had a 2-week trial set for October 20th, 1997. That was canceled. We entered into this judgment. There's a fairness hearing. And the distribution is interesting, and this is what class actions are all about as far as I'm concerned. Total settlement, $4.682 million. The lawyers took $1.4 million out of that. Minus litigation cost, $1.35 million,
mm-hmm.
which left a remaining for distribution of under $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
So you see what the impetus is frequently for plaintiffs' lawyers to do these class action lawsuits. I may be biased, but that's how I read these things. Six foundations got the distribution, and that was fine with us. It included Bridge Community Healthcare in Wausau, Family Health in Wautoma, Howard Young Foundation, Woodruff Memorial Medical Center, Neillsville, Riverview Hospital, Rapids in Wausau, Regional Healthcare in Wausau. Not a lot of money, but the money was going to help people that could not otherwise afford health care.
And was the $2 million divided in equal shares?
Yes, yes, to these institutions. So, we, you know, that's probably the end of it, right? Well, we were also in serious discussions with the Wausau Medical Center in 1996. About possible affiliation of Wausau Medical Center with the Marshfield Clinic. Because we had always hoped that we could affiliate Wausau, Rice Clinic in Stevens Point, and Rhinelander Medical Center, because they're in our service area, we had good working relationships with them, and if they wanted to join a large group, they could join us. Well, FDC, Wisconsin Department of Justice, same Department of Justice that wanted to appeal to file the amicus with the U.S. Supreme Court, became involved in this, and we had to file documents to comply with Federal Trade Commission inquiry. And this was a large transaction, so this wasn't anything unusual. But what was unusual was the FTC and the Wisconsin Department of Justice subpoenas were returnable to Blue Cross's lawyers, Michael Best and Friedrich. So you could see that they were working together at this
yes.
time. We entered into this settlement with the Department of Justice, Wisconsin Department of Justice, on June 18th, signed by Judge Crabb on June 19th. Again, we're going to abide by the law. And we would not acquire any other practices in the Wausau area without notifying the Department of Justice. Primary care physicians, Wausau area was defined as Marathon County for 5 years. For non-primary care physicians, Wausau area was defined as Marathon, Lincoln, Langlade, Portage Wood, the southern half of Oneida, and the western half of Shawano for 3 years. So if we were going to buy those other clinics, we had to let the Department of Justice know about it and have them object if they wanted to. We had to reduce our non-competition clause to 18 months from 3 years, which wasn't a big deal for us. We could do that. We filed a Hart-Scott-Rodino notice with the Federal Trade Commission on June 20th, which was required because of the size of the transaction. The 30-day waiting period ended on July 20th, 1997, with no further action. And we got a no further action warranted letter received by, from the commission on August 19th, 1997. Therefore, we closed on October 1, 1997. But this was a very expensive proposition to file all these documents with the Federal Trade Commission. Again, Jones Day is out, helping us out on all this. But it was important that we affiliate Wausau Medical Center. And as an aside, it's not in here, but during the period of the time of our injunction, Ministry Corporation was able to buy Rhinelander Medical Center and Rice Clinic, which helped them grow their medical clinics greatly. So that's history. The same organization that refused to help us with our appeal bond, if you remember.
Oh, yes.
but the good news about the whole thing is we still have today, we signed in 1999 a contract with Blue Cross, which is what this thing should have been resolved with well before this time. And we've had a good working relationship with Blue Cross since that time.
Really?
We agreed not to balance bill. Their volume is one of our largest insurance companies. And volume is incentives are built into the contract. But we've had a contract ever since this period of time in 1999, just renewed again. Now, there's another chapter, Aetna Travelers insurance issues. Because I'd been negotiating with Travelers during this entire time about paying reasonable attorney fees to Jones Day, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh.
Are there two policies involved because the class actions were filed in addition to the Blue Cross case? So did we really have $20 million worth of coverage as opposed to $10 million? We had extensive negotiations with them. We exhausted the $10 million policy. We blew through that with our cost.
I bet.
But, now we know how to file claims too. So we filed a summons and complaint against Travelers in Wood County Court on March of 1999, because we said, you know, there's two policies. Travelers is not being fair to us. They're trying to limit their exposure. They didn't want to pay their full $10 million, much less the two $10 million policies, which we thought were there. So we claimed bad faith, equitable reformation, estoppel, the existence of a second $10 million policy, actual and punitive damages. We filed this in Wood County Court.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that didn't make Travelers or Aetna very happy at all. And they said, we deny liability. You guys were found partly liable by the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals decision, therefore we shouldn't have to pay anything. Well, the case was signed in Wood County Court, and Travelers moved the matter to federal district court, and who do you think we got as our federal judge? Judge Shabazz. And this is the summer, July. I remember I went down for mediation with Travelers on July 14, 1999, trying to settle this case. We were just unsuccessful at that time. And Judge Shabazz assigned this case, not at Christmas time this year, but he said, we're going to have a jury trial the week of Thanksgiving as opposed to Christmas. We were able to settle that litigation. We had to write off $350,000 off the $10 million policy, but we got rid of the litigation.
Oh.
So we were happy. I think Aetna Travelers was happy. And that's the last we heard about it. Now, what did we learn? You learn who your friends are. You learn you have to have a D&O policy if you're going to be a large organization in a competitive business.
Was that the first time the clinic had bought a D&O policy?
Yes. Yes, it was. A couple years before the case came in.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something Ron Fatterstow and I talked about and decided to go out and try and get.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we were able to get it. The other lessons is that our integrated system was remained intact,
mm-hmm.
didn't fall apart. No one left the clinic, which is really quite remarkable when you got such a huge verdict against the clinic.
Indeed.
It rejected the argument of quality physicians being the essential facility, which is very, very, very critical. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it would have changed the face of medicine, healthcare. The contract negotiating power would have been in the insurance companies, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
The human impact, one will never know the total impact on the people that had to give depositions and that devoted a great deal of energy to defending this thing throughout the whole clinic. It's an external force. Bad things were said about us, but we all held together,
mm-hmm.
which I still...
Like, who had to give depositions?
Well, the three people I named,
right.
Dr. Susan Turney is director of reimbursement. Fritz Wenzel had to give a deposition. I did not have to give a deposition.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our staff in reimbursement had to give a deposition. People in security health plan had to give a deposition. So you have to get everyone prepared. Some of our medical directors had to give a deposition. Not to mention going to court to give testimony. Some of our affiliated physicians had to. But we got through all that. And the clinic held together. And so we had 6 years of litigation. But certainly the firestorm of litigation that had been promised if we didn't settle the case in 1993 came to fruition. Again on Ash Wednesday, 1994.
Reed, did you, when this was all over, a year or two or several later, did you ever do a post-mortem with folks from Blue Cross or Blue Shield?
I've talked to them. I've never done a post-mortem with them or with Jim Chupas. We've talked about other matters, of course. Mm-hmm. I work with them yet. I see Tom Hefty. I communicate, obviously, with Tom Hefty whenever I see him. I don't hold a personal grudge against those guys for what they tried to do. I'm just pleased that we won, though.
Yeah.
Very critical to the history of the Marshfield Clinic.
Very.
And, to have such a substantial antitrust case, it was really quite shocking.
Nothing that you anticipated, Reed, when you joined the Marshfield Clinic.
No. I have this cowboy coffee cup I don't use very much, but it's the old Western guy, scruffy, hasn't shaved in a couple days, hat. His saying on the coffee cup is, there are a hell of a lot of things about this outfit that they didn't tell me when I signed on. So it sort of summarizes a lot.
Yeah.
The good news is the clinic won that case.
And what was the reaction of the clinic after everything was finally settled?
Well, I think there's great relief. But it has paid dividends, because we have a compliance manual for complying with all federal statutes and state statutes, and the antitrust component is quite complete. And we have a contracting policy which came out of this, which said you bring more volume, you get more discount, and it's a sophisticated formula, and we apply equally. So we pay a great deal of attention to complying with antitrust law, mm-hmm. and basic fairness. And I think that helps us in our negotiations on contracts and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there have been some good things that have developed from this. And, I think our patients are better off with us having a contract with Blue Cross.
Yeah.
So they aren't balance billed.
Yeah.
It helps the patient, helps Blue Cross, helps us, because we don't have to go off the small claims court trying to prove $100 claims all the time. There's no dividend in that. You're better off with the contract, if it can be reasonable.
Reed, how big is the clinic now? How many docs do you have?
Just under 800. We have a total of 7,300 people working at the clinic, including our physicians. We have 57 regional clinics. Our combined budget... Well, our budget for the clinic is about $1.2 billion per year now. Huh. Security Health Plan is a substantial additional budget.
And Reed, what's the reach of the clinic these days? How far into southern Wisconsin do you go?
Last year we saw patients from 18 foreign countries, from every state in the nation, every county in Wisconsin. 700 plus different unique patients from Dane County came to our system, not all to Marshfield. Some have cottages up north and are seen at Minocqua, etc. 377,000 different unique patients, 3.7 million encounters between physicians and patients last fiscal year. Mm-hmm. As far as our regional clinics, 57, most of them located in central, western, northern Wisconsin. Our southernmost reach is Wisconsin Rapids, as far as a physical building. Mm-hmm. But we're pleased that we can draw patients from Milwaukee, Madison, La Crosse, Duluth.
And Ashland. Your relations with Gunderson are pretty good, are they?
Yes, yeah. We overlap service areas with them in like Whitehall, Arcadia area, and Eau Claire probably, and Toma. A lot of patients from Toma come up to Marshfield. Mm-hmm. We do not have a clinic in Toma. A lot of patients come out of Monroe County. But we have a good working relationship with Gunderson. Not like the old scientific exchange seminars we used to have with Gunderson, but still a good working relationship with him.
Reed, this is quite significant, and I commend
it has been.
I commend you for your work and your success.
Well, thank you.
But you, I was a small part. Much of this.
But, you know, I wasn't the trial lawyer in court every day. I was there, but I wasn't the trial lawyer. And a lot of people devote a lot of energy to this. I just happened to be general counsel at the time.
And I bet a day did not go by at the clinic when one of your physicians didn't ask you about what was going on.
Clearly, yeah. Especially right after the verdict. I never had white hair before this.
We'll conclude this then. This now concludes the interview with one of UW-Madison's most distinguished alumnus, Reed Hull. Thanks, Reed, very much for doing this.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you for recording such history.